Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. Every single time India has a national election, it's the world's biggest ever. And so it is this week as India kicks off a voting period that will last for 44 days. Polls strongly suggest India's current Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, will return to power. After all, he has a 78% approval rating, higher than any leader in the world. Assuming he does win, what does it mean for Indian politics and economics? And what does it mean for New Delhi's foreign policy? Those questions are the subject of FP's new spring issue. It's got some terrific essays in there, and we've linked to all of them in the show notes. You'll see an essay by Modi's former chief economic advisor, who looks at whether India can become the next China, another growth miracle. There's a profile of India's foreign minister, a man who has ensured New Delhi is friendly with Washington while buying a lot of oil from Moscow. There's also an essay on India's Gen Z and how they are thinking about their prospects under Modi, and much more. I wrote an essay too. It's called The New Idea of India, and the point of it is to raise a provocation. Are the changes we're seeing in India, good or bad, depending on where you sit, a question of supply or demand? In other words, we often see a strongman leader like Narendra Modi as a top-down producer of change. But do young Indians want these changes? You could argue it's a chicken or egg question, but I thought it was a useful avenue to explore. I hope you can read all of these essays on our website, foreignpolicy.com. If you don't have a subscription, this is the time. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That's FPLIVE, one word. In the discussion that follows, I'm handing over hosting duties to my colleague, Amelia Lester. I hope you enjoy it. One more programming note. We're closely following the fallout from Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel on April 13th. We're going to run an additional episode this week looking at whether all of that could lead to a broader Middle East conflict. My guests for that are going to be the Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman and Iran expert Suzanne Maloney. You will not want to miss it. For now, a discussion on India. And now over to Amelia. Let's dive in.
Thanks, Ravi. It's great to be here and to reflect on India at such an important moment in its history with you. We're going to take some subscriber questions, but I thought I'd begin with a few of mine first. Back when you were a reporter, you covered India's elections. Talk to us a bit about just how big Indian elections tend to be.
Yeah, so, you know, while the US presidential elections might be the most consequential for the world in 2024, India's are clearly the biggest. 1.4 billion people by population, 960 million eligible voters, more than 500 million will end up voting, maybe even 600 million. And that's why this has to be spread out over so many weeks. I think it's about 44 days. So it's a spectacular exercise that spans the length and breadth of India and even the height, I should say. There'll be polling booths in the Himalayas. I think it's the highest altitude one in the world. There's a polling booth that's been set up in a forest in Gujarat, which is outside a lion sanctuary. And that's basically for one eligible voter. There's another polling booth that's been set up for 126 people in Himachal Pradesh. And it takes 3 days to trek to get there to set it up. Every time India votes, it's the biggest election in history. So it really is a spectacular exercise.
That's amazing. I wonder who the lion is voting for. Let's get to your essay. You called it The New Idea of India. What's the significance of that title? And what was the old idea of India?
So the title was a bit of a play on a book that was written in 1997 called The Idea of India. 1997 was the 50th year of India's independence. And, you know, the old idea of India, as it were, was the idea of its founding fathers in 1947. And then in 1950, when the Indian Constitution came into being, that particular idea that India's leaders and its people then agreed on was that of a secular republic, a country that had liberal values, whose constitution drew heavily on Western constitutions, but in a very Indian way, and tried to knit together what was still then and still is a country that is a quilt patchwork of different cultures and languages and histories, and tried to knit it together into one idea, one unified idea of what India could be, which was a secular coalition different from, for example, Pakistan, which was founded on the basis of religion. That old idea of India was best embodied, I think, by Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, who was very Western in a sense. You know, this is a person who went to Harrow, was educated at Cambridge. He went by the first name Joe until his 20s, was fairly anglicized. It was very important to him that India remained secular. In a sense, one of his greatest fears was that India would become purely a Hindu nation. It's what he wanted to avoid, despite the fact that 80% of India is Hindu. It has a very large Muslim majority of about 14%. And it was important to him that the country would stitch all of these groups together and be secular.
Okay, so the old idea of India, if you like, was this secular republic. What's the new idea of India?
So I call it the new idea of India, but I should hasten to add it's not actually new in that, as with all ideas, ideas go back in history and have various roots. So in a sense, this is a new old idea of India, but the new idea and the way I framed it was that India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, who's now been in power for 10 years, could get another 5 years, likely will. His vision of India is a vision that prioritizes culture and religion over notions of secularism. For him, his vision of India is a Hindu first country, a country where Hindu religion and Hindu culture, Hindi as well, which is spoken widely in the country's north, which we'll get into later, I'm sure. All of that is prioritized over the older idea of India. And in a sense, his feeling is that India has always been a Hindu civilization, a Hindu country, and its time has come. I say it's a new old idea because the idea is more than 100 years old. There were a range of thinkers in the 1920s. Some of our listeners and viewers will know them, Savarkar, Golwalkar, who first came up with the idea of a Hindu nation. That idea didn't win out in 1947 when India became independent, but it seems to be coming back now as the BJP, which traces its roots to those leaders I mentioned 100 years ago. But as the BJP becomes stronger, as it wins a greater vote share, as it has more power in parliament, it's more likely to prioritize this idea, be more public about it, be more proud and open about it.
I want to get to the embodiment of these ideas, that's Nehru and Modi, in a moment. But first, I wanted to get to the issue of supply and demand. It struck me that the provocation you were trying to advance in your essay was that Modi isn't imposing his will from the top down, as I think it's sometimes represented in the West. In fact, there's a great demand for the BJP's vision of what India should be, isn't there?
Yeah, so this, I think, is the controversial part of my essay, at least. And I've now heard from a lot of people reflecting on that point. And the reason why I made it is that it's very easy to see Modi as this strongman, dictatorial leader with an authoritarian bent. And he is, of course, a magnetic speaker, brilliant orator, especially in Hindi. There's something to him that clearly leads to a larger vote share for his party, the BJP. But it's very easy to sometimes see all of the changes he's bringing to India through legislation, whether it is, again, prioritizing the needs of India's Hindu majority, whether it is all the things that he's furthering through legislation, whether it's changing Kashmir's status, Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, any of those things all seem like they're top down. But what I wanted to put forward is that this is also popular, and it would be wrong to ignore the popularity of Modi, but also the popularity of some of his policies and measures, which are openly telegraphed in his speeches, which are in the BJP's manifesto, which the people are increasingly aware of. And so when they vote for him, it must be coming from somewhere. There must be a broader desire to go along with what the BJP's vision of India is and should be. And the reason why it's important to grapple with the demand side of this equation is that it means that India itself could be changing. If Indians broadly made a social compact in 1947 to be a certain way, to prioritize secularism, and if the social compact is changing, if younger Indians, and half of the country's population is under the age of 25, if younger Indians especially are making a new bet, and their new bet is that this new vision of prioritizing a community, a large religious majority, of prioritizing a leader who believes in a CEO style of leadership that is less collaborative, that is less democratic even, if they believe in that as a vision for where India could head, then it's important to engage with the demand side of that equation, because it means that were Modi to leave, he could be replaced by someone else just like that. And I think for the rest of the world, especially as India approaches these elections, it's important to understand what's changing nationally, not just in New Delhi.
Yeah, that really came through in the essay for me, was this idea that Modi is popular and he's done a lot to improve the lives of many people in India. In fact, subscriber Vibhaka Bakshi points out the massive transformation that Modi has brought about in India and the social welfare benefits he's made available to what Bakshi describes as the deprived sections of the population. And that idea of new welfareism as a cornerstone of Modi's governing has also come through very strongly in the essay that you referenced about economics that's in this issue, which is available to subscribers. But let's go back to the two prime ministers for a minute, India's first and last. How are Nehru and Modi different from each other? You've touched on this, but perhaps you can talk a little bit about their governing styles and how they contrast.
Yeah, so I mentioned a little bit about Nehru's background, of course, very anglicized, fairly westernized, western educated at the very least. Modi is completely different. He is a much more fluent Hindi speaker than an English speaker. He grew up in a lower middle class, lower caste family in Gujarat, is an outsider to New Delhi in a sense. His formative education wasn't at Cambridge. It was through his work as a Hindu community organizer when he was younger, traveling around the country, sleeping in ordinary people's homes, really understanding, getting his finger on the pulse of how average Indians think. And in a sense, their sort of animating principles are different, right? I mean, Modi would be willing to sacrifice liberalism, so the rights of the individual, if he believes that the policies he's executing are in the favor of the greater good, however he defines it. And there's the paradox here is that Modi, of course, you know, he believes that all of the things he's doing, we describe new welfareism, but building toilets or dramatically expanding roads and highways, trains, building new airports, electricity connections, gas connections, all of this is very popular. And he believes he's doing all of this for the greater good. And of course, a lot of that is good. But there is this sort of authoritarian bent to how he conducts policy. And of course, that is different from what Nehru envisioned. So in many senses, it's a different vision, but increasingly a popular one.
Spending a bit of time on how we can think about his governing style, you mentioned a sort of perhaps authoritarian style. Subscriber Andres Paredes Faba wrote in to say, is it possible that Modi's third period will consolidate a more deeply rooted theocratic democracy model as a new path for India in the future, leaving behind the secular idea of the country's founders? Sounds like that would be a fair assessment, perhaps.
Yeah, it could well be. I mean, certainly the salience of religion increases. We saw this earlier this year when there was a temple to the god Ram that was inaugurated in the town of Ayodhya. And that was built on the ruins of a mosque, which was demolished by Modi's party and Hindu mobs associated with it in the 1980s and 90s. And that was very much sort of a display of how it is now okay to have a Hindu sort of figure as pushed forward as the most important thing that the country can unite behind. And in a sense, there was no real national opposition to that either. So it's easy to see another 5 years of Modi could further that proposition. And again, what matters in this particular election is if the BJP ends up dramatically extending its vote share, it gets more seats in parliament, but also the upper house, which changes over time based on elections. And that means the BJP will have even more room to put forward Hindu first legislation, including potentially a national register of citizens, which would make it much easier for the government to deport Muslims, for example, which has been mooted in the past.
On Nehru, too, we got a great subscriber question. Adam from Chicago asks, is it true and is it constructive to associate secularism with liberalism and or democracy, especially in a state like India? Wasn't secularism, in fact, imposed in this state by an authoritarian leader, that is Nehru and then Gandhi, rather than a liberal or democratic leader?
Yeah, I mean, I think liberalism and democracy have clearly been separated in the last two or three decades globally. This is not just in India, not just in Turkey. I think India is becoming a classic example of an illiberal democracy where clearly there is immense sort of voter participation, which has been increasing over the years. The BJP also tends to lose state elections sometimes, but wins nationally. Purely if you look at the electoral aspects of democracy, one could argue that democracy is alive and well in India. But then there are other elements and pillars of democracy that have been greatly weakened, which is where the liberalism angle comes in, secularism comes in as well. You know, freedom of the press has been deeply eroded. The judiciary's strength and autonomy has been eroded over time. And when those pillars get eroded, what happens then is there's sort of a climate of fear. There's a chilling effect, which ends up impacting discourse. It ends up impacting criticism. It ends up impacting policy as well. And those are things that we have now seen in India for some time and could see for much longer accelerating as well, depending on how this election turns out.
Yeah, just some statistics on those points. Voter participation in India is hovering at around 66%, mid-60s, which is about where it is in the US or where it was in the last presidential election in the US. On the other hand, as you mentioned, Press Freedom, Reporters Without Borders now ranks India 161st in the world for press freedom, which is down from 80th in 2002. The World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Index ranks India 127th out of 146 countries. That's also been a precipitous decline. And India has also fallen in rankings on its adherence to law, according to the World Justice Project. Clearly a big shift there. You mentioned this in the essay, but I think it's worth some more discussion. There's a growing divide between India's north and south. Why has that come about and what could it mean in the longer term?
This is a great question. And I mention it in the essay, but there have also been a lot of other terrific essays in recent weeks on this particular issue. So it's become a big talking point in India and elsewhere among India watchers. You know, so India is sort of roughly diamond-shaped. And were you to sort of look at the upper half of the diamond, there's a mountain range that kind of divides India loosely. It's called the Vindhyas. In the northern parts of India, so, above the half, most people speak Hindi. It's a Hindi belt, as it's called. Again, mostly Hindu. And the southern parts include a variety of states, Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, where people speak different languages, of course. It's not a Hindi belt. But much more importantly, I think there's been an economic divergence between the North and the South. You know, for example, a baby born in Uttar Pradesh has a lower chance of reaching the age of five than a child born in Afghanistan. Whereas in Kerala, in India's South, that same baby would have a higher chance than a child born in the United States. There's a difference in education rates. GDP per capita, for example, in some of the southern states is orders of magnitude higher than average incomes in some of the northern states. So there's a real sort of growing divide between the North and South. It's important to note that the BJP is far more popular in the North than it is in the South. And this is partly why I sort of described some of the ruling party's agenda as Hindi first. I think language matters as well because of Modi's proficiency in Hindi. Of course, they embrace other languages as well, but there is a sense of domination of the North. This will end up leading to growing resentment in the South, where people pay higher taxes. This is, of course, where you know India's tech sector is flourishing. And they receive less benefit of those taxes because the North gets most of it. So there is a North-South divide, and that divide could be exacerbated. I think our American viewers and listeners will appreciate this. India is going to go through a process of redistricting, gerrymandering of sorts in the next couple of years. If the BJP wins and is allowed to redistrict to its advantage, then the chances of the BJP winning in the South in a way that it hasn't been able to do so far increases. And that's something we should all look out for. And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, in addition to a range of other benefits, including our magazine. Sign up. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
A question about the political implications that you've touched on there with that growing North-South divide comes from subscriber Brian Smizer. He says, to what extent will South India converge or diverge with the BJP following a likely BJP national win? Sounds like they're pretty much diverging. And then he asks, what are South India's red lines and leverage points to push back on funding the Northern Hindi belt that is comparatively underperforming on education and economy while being the BJP's bastion of political power?
That's a great question. You know, no matter where you sit on the partisan divide in India, whether you're pro-BJP or anti-BJP, I think one thing that everyone should be able to agree on is that you need a good opposition. And India has struggled to put forward a proper national alternative to the BJP. The old alternative used to be the Congress Party, which was Nehru's party. We referred to India's first prime minister earlier. His great grandson, Rahul Gandhi, no relation to Mahatma Gandhi, is currently the sort of lead candidate, the face of the Congress party. But it's widely acknowledged that he's not a very effective leader. He's not a very good orator in Hindi. He's a reluctant leader of sorts, and he's a dynast, which Indians don't like. And so the Congress is basically withering away into obscurity. And, you know, the Congress used to do very well in South India. And there are regional parties in South India that do well across different states. There has to be some way to knit them all together to create a stronger, more united opposition that nationally the country sees as a viable alternative. Again, not to go pro or anti here, but because alternatives are a good thing. And to the point I made originally about a supply and demand issue, part of the problem, many Indians will argue, is a supply problem, in that there is a paucity of great national level alternatives in Indian elections. And so, you know, to the north-south point, it would behoove leaders, regional leaders in various states of South India, to try and knit together, to build larger coalitions, national alliances that are plausible and that have a platform and a sense and a vision. You know, much of this discussion has been about ideas of India. Well, what is their idea of India? How can that compete with Modi's idea of India? We need that.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how you barely mentioned the opposition in your essay. Why do you think they found it so difficult to do precisely what you've just outlined?
I think part of it is because, at least in the Congress party, they've got a leader in Rahul Gandhi who's reluctant. He doesn't quite want to step aside. And yet, you know, he is a reluctant leader. You often get the sense that there is almost anything else he'd rather do than be in the thick of the fray, you know, in the muck of, you know, and the thrust and parry of Indian politics. And so, you know, I in my essay, at least, I didn't think it was worth getting into that, because it is so well known in India, among India watchers. And really, as I said earlier, India needs a stronger, more united opposition. It's also worth pointing out that the BJP has done very well to marginalize its opposition. So they've been able to use levers of the state. And of course, the you know, BJP proponents will say they have not used these levers. This is just the state acting, or, you know, independent institutions acting. But this is where it gets disputed. But, you know, the Congress party, for example, has not been able to access its funds, its bank accounts, because of allegations over tax improprieties that go back decades. The opposition will say, why now? What does that mean? Doesn't that hurt democracy? The BJP will say, but they're corrupt, so this had to happen. So on and so forth. I think overall, though, it does create this sense of, you know, the BJP as this juggernaut that, you know, will win anyway, but seems, you know, quite intent on crushing its opposition and winning with huge margins.
I want to get to foreign policy, but before I do, I got the sense from editing your essay, this shift in India from one idea to another, I don't want to call them old and new because there's some elements of continuity for both, that this shift was personal for you. It might be a repudiation of things you held dear.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, I think people who've heard me or watched me before might know that I don't really sort of align with ideological spectrums. You know, it should be hard to know whether I'm a person of the left or the right, or, you know, any other sort of divides you do want to sort of erect. You know, especially as an editor, I like to be engaged with ideas from all sides. But I do believe in secularism. And I think, you know, that has been a little difficult to see, in that the vision of India that I grew up enjoying was this notion that you could have any faith, and there was a clear place for you in this country. And that seems to be changing a little bit. And it's something that I personally don't enjoy. And I don't see the point of either. I mean, after all, India has 200 million Muslims. You know, were they to feel marginalized, what good does that do? To what purpose? And some of the marginalization, of course, is to mobilize the majority. You know, in my essay, again, there's some discussion about whether this constitutes tyranny of the majority, or is it majoritarianism? And I sort of settle on classic majoritarianism. But how long does that last, and to what end, and what does it do to the minority? Again, I think my sense is, wherever you stand on an ideological spectrum, there's some things that go beyond that. For me, secularism is one of those things. But yeah, at a more personal level, as someone who you know, has lived half my life in India, half of it outside and everywhere else, and, you know, really loves India, it's a little hard to see as well at a personal level the repudiation of, I think, people who bring ideas from through pollination from the West as well. Again, my own vision of India would be one that embraces all of these things rather than shunning them.
I do want to get to foreign policy, I promise, but I did have one question about that notion of secularism fading. We've talked a lot about Modi's treatment of Muslims or how Muslims are feeling in India today, but there are so many other religions in India as well beyond these two religions we've discussed. And of course, because of the population numbers, these are huge numbers of people that we're talking about. What is your sense about how other religious minorities are feeling right now in India?
Yeah, I mean, their rights are also endangered to some degree. If you are Christian, if you are Jewish, Sikhs, for example. Look, I don't want to overplay religious disharmony in India. India's found ways to survive and thrive over centuries in a civilizational way that is quite beautiful. But some of the legislative maneuvers in the last few years, and some that could yet come in the coming years, were the BJP to get absolute majorities. For example, the national registry that I mentioned earlier that FP's reported on a fair bit in the past, were that to become implemented, there are dangers there for Christians who may not be able to prove their identity, prove their citizenship, they're then more liable to be, for example, deported or to not be able to access all of the rights that Hindus or citizens can easily access. This doesn't have to play out that way, but I mean, that's the problem with state rules, right? They often can be used as, you know, a sword that dangles over you, and that's not a good way to live. So there really are significant and real fears for other religious minorities as well.
Okay, we got a bunch of good questions from subscribers about foreign policy. First is, and it's interesting because it does seem like foreign policy is becoming more of a domestic issue. Subscriber Dev Kaur had a question about India's changing foreign policy. He writes that India can win the GDP game up to a certain point, but it will probably lose the larger narrative offered by an inclusive democracy alongside established Western powers. While the pitch that India has its own narrative distinct from the Western model of secular liberalism sells well domestically, as we've talked about, India will find it increasingly difficult to sell that narrative globally. He compares it to the fact that the US has found it difficult under Donald Trump to sort of sell an idea of an illiberal US democracy. Just look at China, Dev writes, to see why GDP, along with muscle power, is not enough. So if that narrow illiberal democracy is not going to be embraced by humanity at large, Dev wonders what your views are on the limits to India's global stature.
That's a terrific question. I mean, for decades now, the United States has liked to sort of say that it is the oldest democracy in the world, India is the biggest democracy in the world, and to use that framework as a way to explain that these two countries are natural allies. I think President Obama once said that the two countries would form the defining partnership of the 21st century. I think globally, and not just in India and the United States, illiberal democracy has been on the rise. At Foreign Policy, we've run many pieces critical of the Biden administration for framing the world as one in which you have democracies pitted against autocracies, that sort of very black and white. And they've stopped using that as openly, by the way. I mean, even with the war in Ukraine, which was originally framed as a democracy-autocracy sort of fight and struggle, now it's being framed more as one of sovereignty, which is smarter because it allows for room for gray and thereby asking for support from other countries that might be illiberal democracies. I think, you know, the world is changing. The world order is clearly shifting. Countries like India smell relative American decline. They smell the rise of the rest. And within all of that, they're looking for a way in which they can get the best deals. They can strike opportune deals for themselves with other countries on a one-on-one basis. But also, you know, something is lost. There's a soft power element that ends up being lost. We don't know at what point that could come back to hurt India. I don't think India is anywhere close to being like China in that sense. It's not anywhere near as authoritarian as China is. And also it's not anywhere near as big or as existential a rival as China is, for the United States at least. So we might be decades away from India's illiberalism really hurting it. But there are clashes and there are tensions. And every time an American leader is asked to reflect on human rights in India or illiberalism in India, you can just see them visibly stumble and almost robotically say, India's a democracy and India, the India-US alliance is unshakable. Yes, sure, literally that is correct. But there are real tensions here, and those tensions will continue to grow and pose problems.
We've got these two big wars happening right now. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is in its third year. The Israel-Hamas war is continuing. And Western democracies have really stumbled in what many in the world see as an inconsistent response to those two conflicts. How would you characterize India's response, and what does that tell us about the new India?
India's response has been to make the most of it, to get what it can out of it. So on Ukraine, and this has been widely reported in FP and elsewhere, before the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, India was purchasing just about 1% of Russia's total crude exports. Today, that is upwards of 50%. So for all the Western sanctions on Russian crude, India's basically mopped up a lot of it on the cheap. Now, this isn't necessarily a bad thing for the world, because if India didn't buy it, global oil prices would also go up dramatically, which would then end up hurting Americans, and it would hurt Biden at the polls. So there's a real sense of understanding that this kind of works for everyone. Russia, of course, is not selling oil at the prices it would like to. It's still making enough money, though. So India gets to buy oil on the cheap, and of course it loves that. It loves to market that internally and externally as a sort of victory of Indian foreign policy. On the Middle East, it's a little bit more complicated. I think India, in Nehru's time, had much more sympathy for the Palestinian cause. Under Modi, the India-Israel relationship has strengthened significantly. So India is more likely now to just sit on the sidelines, try and play both sides, as it often does. You know, the old Indian foreign policy was one of non-intervention, non-alignment. And in a sense, that hasn't changed too much. The bigger change really is India trying to apply its self-interest. They like to call it strategic autonomy. And they like to try and look at any global situation and try and pick the thing that works to its advantage. So they prefer one-on-one bilateral agreements over larger multilateral ones. They prefer to advance their own agenda one-on-one. They sort of use the economy and the market that India represents in a very powerful way. A lot of foreign policy now is economics, as we know. And so in using the Indian market and India's growing purchasing power as sort of a calling card, India is able to play a more muscular, significant role in foreign policy than it could even 10 years ago.
Yeah, for more on this, of course, I recommend that people read Rishi Iyengar's piece in The Issue, which is a profile of India's foreign minister, and which talks a lot more about this idea of a more muscular, strengthened foreign policy in India, flexing its muscles, consumer and otherwise, on the world stage. I wanted to close out with this great question from subscriber Susan Russell. She says, I visited India a couple of months ago. I am worried about my Muslim friend's safety. I'm also bothered that my Hindu friends say they back Modi for business reasons, but they still say political things that are of a more religious cast. She says, I miss the secular pride of India in the past. Will it ever come back?
That's a great question. So the provocation in my essay was that the demand side of the equation has changed. And I may or may not be right. I just wanted to put forward a provocation to get people to think about not just how India's leadership is changing over time, but how its people might be changing. And, you know, the polls may prove otherwise, if not now, then 5 years later or 10 years later. But even if the demand side has changed, even if Modi's vision, his party's vision, the RSS, which is their ideological parent, if their vision is shaping modern India, we only need to look back to history. If there was a different vision of India that proliferated in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and if that could change, then there's every reason why that could change again. And that's the beauty of any contest of ideas. That also makes me a little bit more confident in the democratic nature of debate in India. And if you take a longer civilizational view, there are reasons to feel that, you know, the natural sort of argumentation and debate that is so common and prominent in Indian society in general will at some point yearn for alternatives, yearn for a bigger, renewed contestation of ideas. And you can imagine then that if there are more ideas proposed, newer visions of India, newer ideas of India, that it doesn't have to be static. It doesn't have to be final. This moment we're in could just be a moment of, you know, the clock turning, and it will turn again.
I have to say that our subscribers always make me think. That contest of ideas that you talk about is going to continue in the comments sections of our print pieces. It's always a really robust and interesting conversation there. And the subscribers have asked some fascinating questions today. I think we're out of time, though. Ravi, I'm going to let you play host again and close us out.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Amelia. You're an excellent moderator. Amelia edited most of the essays in the package. Again, if you haven't read them, I urge you to read them, agree or disagree. Leave your responses in the comment section. We'll continue to cover India extensively over the next few months. As I said, it's a big rising power that is very influential on the world stage. And here at Foreign Policy, it's a very important topic for us. And that was my discussion with Amelia Lester on the future of India. I'm going to bring on some India experts in June when the results of this election are announced, and we'll explore what all of that means. As I mentioned earlier, our next episode will be about the chances of a broader conflict in the Middle East. That is with Ronan Bergman and Suzanne Maloney later this week. If you want to keep track of all of this, head to our website, foreignpolicy.com/live. FP Live, the podcast, is produced by Rosie Julin, and the executive producer of FP Live is Donna Shern. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
You can get Disorder wherever you get your podcasts, or you can follow the link in the show notes.